Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Leila Latif.
And I'm David Jenkins.
On the show this week, Wim Wenders paints a portrait of a quiet existence in Perfect Days. Food is the language of love in The Taste of Things, and David spoke to its radiant star, Juliette Binoche. Bob Marley's life comes to screen in biopic One Love, and we'll cover a couple of the highlights of the Berlin Film Festival. Or coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, David, just the two of us, like the subjects of a couple of these films, we're struggling to forge connections beyond one or two people in our lives.
Well, indeed. But, like, I think it's probably worth telling the listeners how our threesome dropped down to two and the reasons. You know, we have to blame Madame Web. I mean, if Madame Web isn't already been blamed for enough in the world. But, yeah, my lovely colleague Hannah Strong was going to be joining us today for the podcast. But due to the fact that there was no, well, I think there was press screenings. No, I don't think there was any press screenings for Madame Web.
I don't believe there were press screens. I think there may have been a few kind of junket ones, but none like kind of for review screenings, no.
A lot of people have kind of carted themselves off to public screenings to see it for review. And, you know, I think it's something that is important as a public service broadcaster that we are to cover. And so, because Hannah's actually going to be flying off to the Berlin Film Festival like early doors tomorrow, so she wanted to fit in a screening of Madame Web before she left. And there was also a fair few logistics involving her lovely cat Margot as well and the cat sitter. So she bailed out at the 11th hour, leaving us to fly solo on this week, which is fine. You know, because I think that people need to know about Madame Web. I mean, you know, when you're listening to this, you know, you're probably going to be thinking like, well, but what about Madame Web? And, you know, and we can't say because we along with everyone else haven't actually seen it.
I don't believe that's something I'm going to carve out any time to see. I've heard not great things. But I've heard there's one really excellent joke, and I don't think I'm going to go and watch it for this one excellent joke. But, I mean, thank you, Hannah, for her service, that hopefully I'll be able to at least find out what the one joke is and then I don't have to bother to actually go and sit through whatever this sort of abomination of a film is.
Yeah, maybe it'll come up on TikTok or something.
Yeah, I mean, they say TikTok is a force for evil, but if it does that for us, I say keep it around. I mean, yeah, it does seem a bit strange though, like the state of the MCU. We've had so many kind of clangers in a row, so many like disappointing ones. This seems to kind of be talked in the same way that like Morbius was. And now there's been an announcement also that they're going to significantly reduce the amount of things that they make and kind of focus on quality over quantity. Does that reassure you in some ways?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, like I think the market has spoken and, you know, that there's been a run of these films that just haven't connected, haven't made the same box office. You know, they had a mighty run where they really had kind of captured the zeitgeist, and they were sort of building this thing where you kind of had to see everything. And I just think they got greedy. You know, they wanted to expand the world too wide, and I think it sort of hit that point where it became evident that people don't just want to dedicate all their precious viewing time to the extremely expanded Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I think that they maybe had, like, it was an equilibrium that they hit very nicely, but then they expanded too far. And, you know, imagine the sort of cinematic outer suburbs that people just don't really want to have the time or inclination to explore. So I think that's where we're kind of at the moment. I mean, it's a cynical thing to say, but, like, I don't think they're going to be able to do what they did again with the Avengers and Captain America and Iron mm-hmm. Man, where they had that, you know, three mega brands that were just doing really well for them. You know, I don't want to see, like, Ant-Man 5. I don't want to see whatever it is, like, Doctor I'm even forgetting their name.
I mean, the fact that you're a film critic and the, we Doctor Who's a whatnot, you know, and
yeah,
Mr.
what's his chops,
funny face, yeah.
But, you know,
I mean, yeah, I guess these things can dominate and then just die. I mean, like, you know, disco died, the western fell
musicals.
Off, like, it seemed hard to imagine 5 years ago, but, like, this, we might be at the end.
Yeah, this is the thing. I'm sure there is probably some rules of, like, or theory of saturation where, you know, you can you kind of jump onto something that's good. I mean, you know, you get it with, like, food trends as well, like, let's do gourmet burgers. Oh, these are successful. Oh, you know, every other shop on the high street is a gourmet burger place, and then there's a kind of Armageddon of gourmet burger places because it's just too much gourmet burger.
I mean, who uses a sun-dried tomato anymore? Do you remember when they tried to reinvigorate the cupcake by making it even more mini? These things, like, you can kind of get a last final gasp for air, but yeah, I agree with you. I don't think we're going to be back in that sort of, like, Black Panther should be winning an Oscar sort of conversation in the foreseeable. But something that has lasted more than the superhero movie, at least, the Berlin Film Festival, where you mentioned Hannah's off tomorrow, and I believe you are too?
Yeah, yeah. I haven't been for a long while, actually. So I'm off on Saturday. I'm really keen because it's the last festival of the current artistic director, Carlo Chatrian, who was previously the artistic director of Locarno Film Festival. And he really not just reinvigorated that festival, but put a very kind of personal stamp on it and made it a very, you know, you really got a sense of what the kind of films that he liked, and there was a real sense of curation. And he's done the same thing for Berlin, and I think there's been a kind of outcry because the festival doesn't perhaps have the kind of glitz and glamour that this kind of A-list festival needs or would be expected of it. And so the lineup does have a fair few kind of esoteric films in it, and, you know, some directors that, you know, he has kind of personally championed over the years. So that's really exciting. So I wanted to kind of go over and actually experience it before he passes on the baton to the lovely Trisha Tuttle, who is obviously, like, was London Film Festival head honcho for many years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm sure she'll take it in her own direction, and you know, I guess, and I'll be very excited to attend a Tuttle festival as well. So I think for a festival like this, it's definitely one of, like, exploration of, like, you know, diving into the sort of weird and wonderful sidebars and trying to find something new rather than sort of having things that you're excited for. So yeah, that's my kind of focus for the sort of window that I'm going to be there.
Anything that you're particularly kind of going to make sure that you carve out time to see?
Yeah, I think there's a new film by the South Korean filmmaker Hong Sang-soo, who makes, you know, a couple of films every year. You know, I think they're sometimes sort of hit and miss, but he's hit a really good stride at the moment. And this current one that he's made has got Isabelle Huppert in it. So his second one with Isabelle Huppert. So that should be fun. I'm looking forward to, like, the new film by the French filmmaker Bruno Dumont, who, you know, his career started where he'd made these highly controversial, like, you know, violent and sexualized art movies that really kind of alien, like, people seemed to, you know, they were real kind of love or hate prospects. And then he kind of just sort of gravitated towards comedy and satire. And in the last couple of years, he's been focusing on comedy, and he's made, like, a comedy sci-fi film called The Empire. So I'm really keen to see what he does with that. And it's got, like, big special effects in it, and, you know, he's made kind of mystery sci-fi horror film, like, TV before, because he's in this series he did called Little Can Can, which is really, really funny. But yeah, his stuff is still sort of wild and very much a kind of love it or loathe it prospect still. But yeah, I'm excited to see what he does with that.
Anything that you're slightly wary of that's coming out, not to be too much of a downer?
Not really. I mean, I think that the line lineup is pretty solid. They've hoovered up the kind of best of Sundance as well. So you've got Rose Glass's Love Lies Bleeding, Annie Baker's Janet Planet, and also Aaron Schimberg's Different Man.
Wasn't Janet Planet from
You're right. Janet Planet was from New York Film Festival. So yeah, that's from there. But there's a few other Sundance titles in there as well, which, you know, I either catch up with there or wait until they come out later. But as I say, it's best as a festival for discovery for me. Like they've got this sidebar called The Forum, which has more artsy, difficult fare where you're going to be challenged and you're going to see something that you've probably never seen before. And in previous times that I've been to the Berlinale, I've always tried to sort of at least once a day dip my toe into the Forum and just pick something random to see the other side of cinema. So yeah, I'm excited to do that again this year.
But even though it's been a while, was there like a particularly great experience that you ever had with just kind of dipping your toe into the experimental side of cinema and taking a risk that really, you know, reaped rewards?
Oh yeah, I think maybe one of them was seeing Leviathan by Lucien Casting Taylor and Verena Paravel, who are part of the Harvard Ethnographic Film Unit.
Of my beloved De Humani Corporis Fabrica.
Indeed. And this was one of their early films that they did. You know, they had this one film called Sweetgrass, which was very good, but this was on another level. And, you know, it was at the Locarno Film Festival. It may have even been a Carlo Chatrien programmed festival. I can't remember that exactly, but yeah, it was a real, like, wow. You feel like you're there seeing something completely new, completely exciting and radical, and, you know, the language of cinema sort of, and the possibilities of cinema kind of changing in front of your eyes. So yeah, that was probably a really memorable one for me. Obscure one, but memorable one.
I'm gonna seek that out. De Humani, I think, actually generally changed my perspective on, like, literally what the entire form could be. And somehow we haven't covered it on this podcast, but I don't know if that's because it never was technically released.
It sort of slipped out very subtly, but I think it was on Mubi. It might be on Mubi still. Maybe Mubi feels like a good home for it. So
yes, the fine people of Mubi are listening. For the love of God, put it on your platform if it isn't already. But yes, we should move on to our first film. Someone who arguably did change the fabric of cinema, but has been acknowledged for it. It's Wim Wenders' Perfect Days.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. We receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies.
Hirayama seems utterly content with his simple life as a cleaner of toilets in Tokyo. Outside of his very structured everyday routine, he enjoys his passion for music and books, but a series of unexpected encounters gradually reveal more of his past. So, David, I've spoken to you at length about the miracle that is Paris, Texas. Wim Wenders does nothing better than a sort of protagonist with a lot of inner turmoil. Do you think he sort of captures the same magic in Perfect Days?
I think he's definitely going for that same magic. As much as I think this is a very fine film, I don't perhaps think it's up there with something like Paris, Texas, or like some of his earlier ones like Alice in the Cities. But I mean, the thing to say when contextualizing this film and talking about it as a Wim Wenders film is this: it's maybe his best film since his best fiction film, at least since Paris, Texas, because he has definitely been someone who has, not dropped the ball, but he's made some films that are very kind of personal and like very quite strange, that just, they kind of lack a connection. They don't work. Some of them genuinely very bad. Million Dollar Hotel, you know, his 90s were bad, and I think people were hoping that he'd come back in the noughts, and he really had it. And if anything, his noughties were even worse.
Yeah, I've seen some pretty terrible ones. Wasn't there a Josh Hartnett vehicle? Oh, yeah, a lot of things that you kind of erase from your memory.
Yeah, I mean, he was definitely doing fiction films, and, you know, he was pulling in some really big stars. I mean, he did... His previous fiction film to this one was called Submergence, with Alicia Vikander, and it was a very Wim Wenders film. It was almost like a Wim Wenders meets the James Cameron film, in that it was a woman who goes in sort of very deep sea submersibles and has kind of these hypnotic experiences when she's sort of down in the water, and she's having this love affair with James McAvoy, who's on dry land. And it's like I can see what you're doing here, but it's just wrong and absurd. And I guess getting back to Perfect Days, he's finally kind of worked out the algorithm again, you know, that he's worked out how to make a fiction film that feels pleasurable and coherent. And, you know, I think that a lot of the issue with the films he's been making over the last sort of almost fiction films over the last like 30 years is like, I feel he's really strained for meaning. Like, he's really strained for profundity. Something that he kind of gets quite easily with his documentaries, like Anselm and Pina as well, which are the two really great films he has made this century. And I think it's a relief to be, if anything else. And I think that, you know, it's great that he's being able to do this kind of victory lap. It's, you know, the fact that it's Oscar nominated, and, you know, he's back on the scene. And, you know, I think he deserves it.
I mean, the fiction films that you mentioned, you mentioned obviously Paris, Texas, which is sort of a place. Wings of Desire is one of my favourite ever film. But also I think Pina and Anselm have got a real sense of the place that like birthed these people, and the way that sort of like informs every kind of frame of the film. Do you think part of what makes this a return to form is because it's got such a sense of like Tokyo?
Absolutely, yeah. It's probably worth mentioning that he's known for his road movies. That's the name of his production company. And, you know, he tends to make films about people going on these journeys. And sometimes he makes films about his own journeys. And he made one in fact, just before he made Paris, Texas, called Tokyo Ga, about his trip to Tokyo, basically documented by himself and Robbie Muller. And it's him sort of searching for his love of the films of Ozu as well, who has been a massive inspiration for him. And that film, Tokyo Ga, it's a really fun film, but there's definitely a case of like tourist outsider who is kind of slightly exoticizing the landscape a little bit, and is kind of slightly bemused by some of the kind of local custom, and the fact that they have like, you know, wax models of the food, and they play pachinko, and, you know, there's something that's a little bit kind of like, isn't it strange over here? Whereas I think with Perfect Days, there's much more kind of like, he's much more embedded in Japan, in Tokyo. There is no sense of like he is the outsider gazing in. He is the tourist. He's trying to immerse himself in this world and trying to make something a little bit more like credible and authentic. And it does feel like, you know, you could watch this film and it'd be like, oh, this is a kind of Koreeda might make a film like this, you know. And you could maybe like not tell that it was from someone who wasn't from Japan.
I mean, as films go, this is very, very dialogue light. And actually, people that I've spoken to have seen and like really admired this film seem to mostly kind of bring up the kind of final shot, which is like dialogue free, which is just someone's sort of expression changing back and forth. I mean, I suppose we shouldn't spoil it too much, but do you think that perhaps operating not in his own language, like there might be a bit of an over-reliance on dialogue-free imagery in order to sort of compensate for that, to not kind of be like the perpetual outsider?
Maybe, but I think there's enough dialogue from other characters. I mean, it's you know, so to explain that the main character, he's a toilet cleaner, but he's someone who's presented as being very comfortable and content with his job, because what his job allows him to do is kind of seek these other very, like modest pleasures in his life, one of which is watching baseball, and he likes to read like William Faulkner novels, and he likes Western rock music, and, you know, he collects tapes, like rather than CDs or records, he listens to them on tape clips as he drives around in his van. And I guess there is something that is like celebrating that sense of quietude and the humbleness of this existence. You know, I think that what the film is saying is that, you know, you can find pleasures in the smallest things if you're willing to kind of be patient and willing to look about them, and maybe sometimes even willing to not question them in your own mind. And yeah, the main protagonist's, you know, hushed sensibility is very much part and parcel of the person he is, and it doesn't feel like contrived that he doesn't speak very much. Although that's what should be said is that, as you hinted before, like, although he doesn't speak, he's still extremely expressive, and the performance is incredible in many ways, and it feels like a kind of silent film performance in that he projects emotion through the kind of facial nuance, and you know exactly what he's thinking and feeling for most of the films, and how he kind of projects to the camera and to other protagonists in the film.
Yeah, no, the performance from Koji Yakusho is absolutely extraordinary. He's got kind of, there's something haunting about his face, and I do believe the sort of emotional, you know, vacillations of like so many of those scenes that where we only kind of see them through his expressions would be really, really hammy in the hands of 99.9% of actors.
Yeah.
It would be seeing something that's a bit kind of caricaturish.
Yeah, and I, in fact, I think that this is probably going back to something about Wenders, that one of the things that has sort of like damaged some of his recent, well, most of his recent fiction films, is that he is quite a sentimental filmmaker. Like he you know, he kind of lavishes in sentimentality, and I think this film and this setup, it has potential to be very sentimental, like very, very kind of, you know, gooey, and it's just and it just avoids that. So it's like, you know, I think it feels like he's acknowledging this thing that he's been doing for so long that has hampered so much of his work, and has actually reversed it. But in a film that you think, that it's weird that you think it could have been his most sentimental film ever, and it kind of isn't, because it's just a bit more sort of subtle and steely, and a bit more sort of, you know, he's far more kind of relaxed and not so desperately intent to make these kind of grand statements about the world, and in doing that, I think he achieves the opposite, which is a positive. Like, he does, you know, it is a richer film for the fact that you're not being kind of told stuff, and you're not being told what to feel and what to think.
Yeah, it sounds terrible, but like, now all I can think is whilst we're contemplating the sort of subtlety of Wim Wenders, Hannah is stuck somewhere hearing about how someone's mother died whilst researching spiders in the Amazon.
Well, yeah, yeah.
Like, but that level of just, oh, good Lord.
There's a rumour that line has been cut from the final film, so she might not even be hearing that. So it's worth mentioning, though, that Hannah is a big fan of this film. And she did an on-stage interview with Wenders and had a great time. And you know, I think if we pretend that she was here, if we're speaking on her behalf, which we always should do, I think, then we should say that she's a big booster for this film as well.
But in terms of like cold hard tacks, what are your scores going to be in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Well, I'm gonna say, like, probably honestly my anticipation was 2, because I have been stung by Wim Wenders fiction films many times, and you know, I didn't see this one in Cannes, so it had a much better reception. So actually, maybe up that to 3, because you know, it did, you know, there was a wave of people who were like, you know, this is actually him back on form. So, you know, maybe that's a 3, probably 4 for enjoyment, and then maybe a 3 for in retrospect. I think it's a very pleasurable experience, but it kind of just, you know, it sort of whisked away from me after seeing it. And but I think in many ways that's part of its charm. I don't think it's a film that's going to sort of necessarily change people's lives, but it's a very kind of zen, pleasurable, contemplative entertainment as and when you're watching.
Yeah, I'm not far off. I'm probably at a 4.3, 4.4, because I loved Anselm so much, and so I really did think that we were on an upwards swing when it came to Wenders. 3 in enjoyment, because yeah, I mean, when you have 2 films, I think, so close together, it's almost like you are forced to choose sides. And I felt like, oh, I am a Wim Wenders nonfiction renaissance person. I'm an Anselm. Like, but yeah, 4 in retrospect. I think it was, the only one that comes to mind is lovely. I think it was kind of, there's something like exquisite about it. even if it doesn't quite kind of create the same existential reimagining of the self that something like Wings of Desire does. But yeah, next up, it's The Taste of Things. Cook Eugenie and her boss Dodan grow fond of each other over 20 years, and their romance gives rise to dishes that impress even the world's most illustrious chefs. When Dodan is faced with Eugenie's reluctance to commit, he begins to cook for her. Before we get into the film itself, here's David talking to the one and only Juliette Binoche.
Hopefully it's recording.
The first question I'd love to know is, like, how familiar were you with the films of Tran Anh Hung and prior to coming on board with this project? And
right.
When you kind of come on board with a filmmaker like this, do you look at their work or study?
Well, I knew the Center for the Green Papaya and, you know, enjoyed the way of entering this world, mm-hmm. and the sensuality that he's not frightened of. Mm-hmm. And then Cyclo was suddenly something else.
Yeah.
And in the, you know, the violence and a very different territory, but being Vietnamese, I found it so interesting that it could go that far with it. And then I didn't see the American films, you know, he's done. He's done mm-hmm. a couple, I think.
Oh, yeah, the one he did in between.
Yeah, I didn't see that.
Yeah, the last one I saw was the Norwegian Wood.
Right.
Kami,
oh, right, right, right. Did, yeah. Then I saw the Eternity that he did in France. I saw that, and I wasn't sure at the beginning when I started watching it. And then as we were going into the film, I was really attached to it. Mm-hmm. Because I understood what he was doing, even though I was a little frustrated with the acting. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when he proposed me, because we bumped into each other, he came on the set of the Hao Shao Shen film.
Yeah.
And so we spent a little time together, and I liked his way of being, you know, this kind of soft-hearted mind. And that has this fragility that you can feel and strength at the same time, because it has really both together. Mm. And so we talked about, you know, working together. But when I saw Eternity and knowing that we were going to be shooting together, when I read the script, I thought,
really?
I'm going to be, no. The interpretation. Wait for what I'm saying.
I'm sorry.
I will make sure that there's emotion in every single shot, because in Eternity sometimes it was this kind of flat way of acting. Mm-hmm. That is interesting, because you're going through, you know, from one generation to the other to the other, so the film does it for you. Mm-hmm. But I felt it was also some places empty, and so that I thought, I'm not gonna let it happen. Mm-hmm. So a couple of times he came to me while we were shooting and he said, can you play neutral? And I said, no, I can't. So, and he was a little astonished that I answered, you know, to him. So straightforward, no, I can't. I don't know what you mean by neutral. And
is that even a possible state to be in as an actor, really?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Because it's a mind request. Mm-hmm. It's not a body request, because, you know, as actor, you've got to link every stages of the human being. But it reminded me, actually, of Bruno Dumont, who asked me while we were shooting Camille Claudel. He said to me, now, this scene, I don't want any emotion. I want the camera doing it for you. So I said, okay, what does he mean by that? He said, you don't do anything. I'm going to cut the scene in pieces. And if you had, you know, it was like to above, how do you call it? A bulle saying, I will do like Eisenstein. You know, that what it felt like, you know, his thought was Eisenstein, you know, superiority. And so actually he shot the moment I'm on the table writing, and there's a moment I'm overwhelmed and my pen falls and I fall and I'm upset. Mm-hmm. So I followed his road, what he wanted to do, and mm-hmm. I didn't involve myself emotionally. Mm-hmm. And he cut it in the film the way he wanted, but for me, it didn't work.
Right.
That moment is not good acting, doesn't believe, I don't believe it, even though he tried with the cut of the film. So knowing I have a little history with that, and asking this specific of the neutrality, which meant for me, I want to be in control of what's going on. Because, of course, the actor being in front of the camera, the director needs the actor and cannot control everything. Mm. So in refusing to be neutral, it was my implication of, you know, as a free artist to say, this is not the way I want to go.
But then everyone else seems to be on board with you as well. I mean, you know, Benoit and all the other actors, they're kind of operating at that level too. You know, no one else is being neutral.
No, but it was only that moment, probably because I asked him, why did you ask me that at that moment?
What was the moment? Do you remember?
It's when I'm saying, I think it was the moment I'm eating this soup after being sick, you know, recuperating, and it comes with a broth and to put myself together. And when I'm saying, I'm so happy. And I'm so reconnaissante. Mm. I don't know how you say that in English. Je suis tellement reconnaissante. I'm so grateful.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful. And he wanted me to be neutral at that moment. There's no way. Because it's about me talking to Benoit. And so I asked him afterwards, you know, and he said, well, because I worry sometimes that actors overact, which is my fear as well. I hate acting and I only love the being, you know, and not seeing the acting, which I think it's terrible. But I'm glad I resisted, because I usually don't resist very much, because I love giving the best I can. And I think it's really a cooperative work, co-creation work. So I like to say yes, because it's more heart lifting for everyone. But on this one, I needed to make sure that he allows the emotion to live. Mm-hmm. And at the end, you know, after a few takes, I did maybe three different versions. He tap on my shoulder and say, I think it's good.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
And on that note, this is a different film, but one of my favorite moments of yours in any film is in the scene in Code Unknown where I think it's Michael Haneke is directing. He's telling you you're trapped in the room.
Right.
Do you remember that scene?
Yeah, of course.
And I just, not only is it a remarkably dramatic and chilling scene because you're playing it so realistically, it's an incredible film about a piece about the relationship between the director and the actor.
Right.
And it's sort of, from that scene, there seems to be a suggestion of like, there is the director is the god and the actor is kind of the prisoner almost, you know? Do you see that relationship a lot?
Not at all.
Or is this something that Haneke is sort of playing with a bit?
Haneke loves actors because he knows how difficult it is, how he's depending on them, how he needs them. And also because he's been doing some workshops with a coach called Susan Batson. So he knows what it means. And he's learned with her as well the layers of acting. And I never felt like he was playing God at all on set. No, I never felt that. I felt more a collaboration, and mostly, you know, with great directors, it's like that. At the end of the day, of course, they're choosing the, you know, the takes and the drawings, if I may say, of the, you know, the ups and downs of the emotional journey and with the takes they're choosing. But it's still depending on the actor's skills of being able to give, you know, despite themselves sometimes. But I've never seen it being a hierarchy kind of co-creation. Mm-hmm. I've always felt it was a codependent. And usually if I had felt that, you know, dichotomy, is because they're two young directors who don't understand that, you know, they've got a modesty is the first time to really get into co-creation. It's the first step to go, you know, and so it's a lack of maturity, in my opinion. But, you know, in that scene you're talking about, it's like, show me your real face. Show me your real face. You know, it's your true face is an interesting question.
Yeah.
You know, what's the true face? And it's a question that an actor has to ask himself or herself It's like, what is my truth? Where do I start? What's my root? And there are many paths to go into that root. And with a Susan Batson, for example, you go with the, you start with the need. What is your need as a person, actor, mm-hmm. playing the part, but also for the part? What's the need you're choosing for the character you're playing? But sometimes the not knowing is even deeper. So it happened to me that I chose to not know anything. And it's so frightening because you have to expose yourself into this jump of not knowing. But it's so interesting to put yourself in that state. Mm-hmm. You have to trust so much yourself in that unknown, and so much yourself, and so much the director as well.
On that note, I'd love to know a little bit about that sort of idea of knowing and I guess sort of entering into a character. And I'd love to know for this film, how much did you look into the kind of history and the maybe looking at the original book that the film is adapted from? Like, I know that your character in there doesn't really have much of a presence, and this is the kind of...
Yeah. No, the book had read like 35 years before.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I knew about the book, but I knew also that he was going to do a prequel of it because Eugenie's character is not really
she's like
present.
Memories, isn't she?
Yeah, she's a flashback kind of a character. And so I didn't go back to the book because I didn't need to. And also I cook, so, you know, I didn't need that much of prep for it. And of course, I went into Wikipedia to understand who was Antonin Carême because I didn't know him, and the Escoffier that came afterwards, and all that, you know, sort of French art of cooking that was coming with the story of Antonin Carême. And it's very moving in a way because it was coming from a family of 14 kids and was left on the side by the parents and was... you know, adopted by a family who was a cook, and then he went to another cook, and they were sent to study architecture and came back into cooking and putting together the architecture, these big cakes of like monuments, you know, mm-hmm. like castles and churches and whatever. And so it's interesting to know that. But I didn't have to, you know. There are films you don't have to prepare mm-hmm. because you know you have enough in you and you're going to discover as you're going into it. And also, my kitchen has always been a very important place mm-hmm. at home. I've always had the best conversations in that area, and that's where family... gather and where, you know, the most interesting conversations happen because you're in the middle of action of doing things and meanwhile you feel like sharing or you feel like drawing or painting mm-hmm. or because while, you know, the kids are painting also because meanwhile you're preparing the cooking because you want to make sure you're, you know, they're not in the other side of the house or the apartment.
One thing I love about the film actually is like, I mean, most of it takes place in the kitchen. I mean, mm-hmm. probably the majority. Mm-hmm. The way it's set out and the way the tables are and where there's the little table in the corner and where the doors are, it seems like dramatically the sort of perfectly aligned space. What was it like? Did you have kind of free access to the space when you're kind of acting in it? Or
oh, absolutely. Yeah. But it was specific. I mean,
was it a set? It was a set.
I mean, it was not in a studio, but mm-hmm. we really shot in that little castle.
Yeah.
That's near Angers. And often we refer to that region like la douceur angevine, the softness of that region, Angevine. And because it's a very mild place where it's not too cold in the winter, it's not too hot during summer. So it's a kind of a place that is protected and soft and warm. And so this room where they put the kitchen, this big kitchen, they transformed that salle de garde, we call it, mm-hmm. which is when you get inside the castle, that's like the big entrance. At the time, they had this big entrance thing. So they really put the stove in and the table and made, you know, different areas in order to tell the story. Where, you know, the place where Dodin is writing his recipes and, you know, where you take the water and they added a little ancient stove from the 17th century next to the chimney. And so that was particularly, you know, chosen by Hung, who's very precise in his way of preparing. And I think, you know, he calls himself a technical director, mm-hmm. because he knows how to use the camera, how to tell the story, you know. And I have wonderful conversations with him about directing, you know, like saying the cut is really what makes a director. Where do you cut? And the contrast between one shot and the next one, how the contrast can be only in the sounds or only in the light, or that you discover something always new as you go into another shot. And it's fascinating. And why do they? He puts us into a sequence, you know, instead of having a you know, a shot and a reverse shot. Mm-hmm. And so all this is very specifically chosen. And what I love working, you know, with him is that, of course, he's thinking about, you know, how to shoot. But at the same time, he's very open. When you come on set, prepared to go and shoot, hair and makeup and costume done, he wants to know how you genuinely go around and how it can happen. So there's a feeling of freedom and yet being taken care of, because it's the worst when you go on a set and the director has no idea how to shoot things, mm-hmm. because you feel, okay, I'm going to do it then. And so you have to have somebody sustaining that responsibility of, mm-hmm. you know, of I'm going to shoot you and I'm going to take care of the scene. And yet being open enough to be able to participate as a co-creator, mm. or as an actor.
This might be a little bit of a technical question, but I find this kind of fascinating. I understand, like, when actors are shooting with food, like, if you're doing lots and lots of takes where you have to kind of keep eating, thinking of that, like, sequence where you where Dodin is making you the huge meal, How long did that take to shoot? And what were you having to eat all these oysters over and over and over again? Is there a way to do that? Technique?
You know that when you have to eat in a scene, you have to eat for real.
Because so much of the film is about you reacting as well.
Of course, yeah. And he wanted us, you know, with the other actors, to experience real beautiful cooking. Like an art way of cooking. So he wanted to shoot the surprise of it. And so there was not a lot to act because it was there. And so also very, you know, when you know you've done the first take being good, mm-hmm. well, unless you call Kieslowski and you don't need a second take, but usually you do a second take just in case there's a problem. So that's what we did. But when it's good, it's good. You move on to the next shot. Mm-hmm. And usually what happened is that Hung would ask me if I would do another one. And sometimes I'd say yes, and sometimes no, we're fine. I think we're fine. We got it. So, but there was, I don't recall it, you know, being like, oh, once more time. Because it's one more time. Because it was, you know, when it's perfect food, you know, you just react with this person. Perfect palace, and that's fine. You carry on. It's not palace. How do you say palette?
Palette. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. I wondered also how Pierre
Gagné.
Yeah, yeah. Were you working with him at all on the film? Did he give you any, when it came to the kind of cookery? Like, what one of the things I absolutely love in the film is, and I think it's one of the most thrilling shots in the year, is when you take the turbot out of the pan, because you're kind of like your heart's in your mouth hoping that it doesn't kind of fray. I'm watching it and think, oh my god, that the technique is incredible, and
right,
it feels like, you know,
right,
really professional, you know, that this is part of like your
right,
total, you know, ingrained in you. And I wondered if Pierre had sort of given you all lessons or,
right,
or, you know,
I didn't meet Pierre until the end of the film.
Oh, okay.
He came on set while we were shooting once, and so I met him there. Oh, I met him before that because I went to his restaurant once before, you know, like a few years before. But his right hand, who's been working with him for 46 years, was there all the time. Mm-hmm. And I was asking all the questions I had and wanted to have some tips as well, because, you know, you want to hear all the secrets about cooking, of course. Yeah. But the turbo thing, what Piaz is saying is that, first of all, as a chef, you need love. And then after, you need technique. He doesn't put the technique before the love.
Right.
And I found it interesting. And also he said, at the time when he says, when I studied as a chef, as a cook, the turbo was much bigger. He could get big turbo and very cheap. And now they're smaller and expensive. That's what he said about the turbo. But for me, it reminded me of my grandmother, because she used to, like veal, she would do into milk. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know the turbo was, you could do it with milk as well. That I didn't know.
Is your grandmother who you learned cooking from? Or what,
Both grandmothers. I observed, you know, some of the cooking they were doing. Mm-hmm. And I do cook the same things they were doing, because it's related to them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's related to the being fed by love, really. So you want to have that feeling again.
Yeah.
And give it to your children as well. I think it's very important to teach your children how to cook a little bit, because it's like a root of being human, making sure that they can go in life with some ways. It's like language.
Yeah.
You want your child to be able to speak. You want to have your child able to cook.
I'm laughing a bit because I have a young daughter, and she's rich. She loves cooking. But she wants to kind of run before she can walk. If you know what I mean.
Very well.
She wants to do everything.
Yeah, I know very well.
Another element of the film that I really loved is this idea of the Pauline character coming on as an apprentice, and you're sort of taking her under your wing, and, you know, talking about, you know, just referring to what you were saying about your grandmother and passing this knowledge on. And I wondered, it's like, do you, as an actor, do you have lots of young people asking questions to you, wanting to sort of be a kind of apprentice to you, or, mm-hmm. You know, are there people that you kind of take under your wing?
Yeah, I've been sharing questions about acting, and I'm always interested, because it's about humankind and how you recreate life through you. You know, and it's always very interesting. What's the, you know, the inside path you have to take? Because it's always between how do you deal with the needs outside and what's inside, and how do you come towards the outside from the inside? And so it's the back and forth that is fascinating. And how do you put those words into a real feeling, or, you know, feelings into those words? How do you put it together? It's always a fascination to me, because it's a learning process. It's a lot of undoing ideas, you know, breaking stuff inside you that wants to prove you can do this, or the will is like a wall that doesn't allow you to really be. Mm-hmm. And so it's how do you get, you know, how do you transform this will into a path and not to into blocking you? And it's all this, you know, questions that are so fascinating, and for me, that's why I love acting still, because it's in front of a camera with, you know, lots of different energies and demands, and, you know, it's how do you put it together so it becomes you know, deep and light at the same time, and reachable and yet mysterious. It's all this chemistry that is fascinating. Mm. So I always love talking about it, because it's more into questions more than answers as well. And as a young actor, I remember, you know, not always being able to understand how you reach this place. It's like the fil d'Ariane, you know, the Ariane thread. Your own journey belongs to you, but yet you have to really open your ears and eyes to really, you know, see a possible way to transform, because it's all about transformation, really. Mm-hmm. Always.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Hey, If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
In a film like this, where kind of food itself becomes kind of a bit of a cinematic language, I'm wondering, like, has your perspective on food and film changed ever since a few years ago you did the sort of food and movies issue of Little White Lies?
No, not really. I think that, like, you know, that issue we kind of did in the deep of COVID, where food had become a real central pleasure of people's lives because of the scarcity of, you know, live culture and, you know, basic human interaction as well. So, like, you know, it really felt like, I think we jumped on that idea because it really felt like people were expressing themselves artistically, culturally through, like, preparing food, because that was one of the few things left that people could do. And, you know, it was nice to kind of dive back into food movies. One of my all-time favorites is, like, Stanley Tucci's Big Night.
I make a timbalo every time I'm sad.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's, how often are you sad? You don't seem you're sad that often. I mean,
I don't know. I think we probably get a seasonal timbalo, like once every 4 months a timbalo comes out.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So I think that, like, then you don't get many food films of this caliber. This is kind of, for me, up there with the absolute best of them. If not one of the best. I was a big fan of the director Tran Anh Hung, who'd made this amazing film called The Scent of Green Papaya. Very similar tonally, in that it's kind of capturing the minutiae and very, very sensual filmmaker. Capturing very, very sort of sensual aspects of like family life in a house in Vietnam. And this one is kind of him bringing this sensibility to a sort of early 20th century, I guess, French farmhouse, where in which you have Juliette Binoche as a kind of master chef, I guess. And or you know, she refers to herself as a cook in the film. And then you have Benoît Magimel as Dodin, who is he's a gourmand. He's like a revered gourmand, and, you know, someone in whom people have, you know, great respect. And he seems to live this life of coming up with ideas for menus and coming up with ideas for dishes, and having Binoche's character Eugenie make them for him. So she is the, like, in many ways, he's, you know, he's the director and she's the cinematographer. You know, she's the one who is kind of wrangling with the light, while he's the one who's sort of like telling her what needs to be achieved. I mean, I think food films, I'm less interested in food films that are about, like, showing completed food, you know, like, here is the end product of some food, isn't it beautiful, because that's just kind of like marketing magazine-y kind of stuff, whereas like this film is about the process. In fact, it's not even that interested in like the final product, but it's about like how you actually get to that final product, how you make the world's biggest vol-au-vent, you know. And you know, I think that there's some of the most beautiful things I saw in the cinema last year was Juliette Binoche cooking a turbot in a fish kettle, and the way she kind of handles the fish with just the utmost respect and almost kind of eroticism. I don't want to maybe overstate that too much, but there is like, it's all about the kind of tactility of cooking and presenting things, and it's like, and the artistry as well of making these beautiful dishes and meeting a sort of standard that is so high that most will not even kind of comprehend, like, you know, why this is good, why this works, why this is a kind of magnificent achievement. So yeah, but there is also a romance.
Well, I always think food is a love language, even I believe for pop psychology that's a sort of theory that's been pretty widely discredited. But yeah, it's one of the reasons I love Eat, Drink, Mad Woman so much in terms of like food movies, because like it has a kind of similar setup, not quite as long as this one, but it starts with this like meticulous preparation of a incredible looking meal, and then they sit down to eat it and the family acknowledge that doesn't actually tastes very good, because it turns out, you know, the man, you know, the chef father who's been preparing it is losing his sense of taste. And it sort of acknowledges the limits of cinema and actually conveying like actually what, you know, this is the sensory experience of food is. But David, I would just say that you did accidentally massively insult Dodan earlier on, because one of as a previous person who worked in the food industry, there is nothing worse that you can call someone than a gourmand. The truest insult you can say to someone is that you are not a gourmet, you are merely a gourmand. A gourmet is a person with fabulous taste. A gourmand is just a greedy person.
Interesting. Well, I stand corrected I take your semantic lesson.
Well, now when you're in highfalutin food circles, you know how to kind of passive aggressively insult someone.
A gourmand is a sort of self-styled gourmet.
Think the program Man versus Food, that's a gourmand.
Interesting. Well, you know, I think I've maybe been using that term incorrectly for my entire life.
You've probably left a lot of upset people in your wake.
But yeah, I mean, it's a very, like, his role is, I don't believe you'd have someone like him in existence now. People who do what he does in the film are essentially celebrities. Like, they want to be kind of adored in mass circles, and they, you know, they want to sort of, like, get their stuff out there. Whereas he is a very private guy. You know, he is someone who, getting invites from like royalty passing through, he's umming and ahhing whether to accept the invite and experience these kind of ostentatious menus that have been put together. The original title for the film was called Pot-au-feu, which is reference to a dish that he goes to this dinner with a prince, and it's like, you know, the amount of courses they have is just absolutely obscene. It's like almost rolling into to sort of triple figures, and he decides in as his riposte, he's going to invite the prince over and make this thing called pot-au-feu, which is like the most kind of humble, hearty French peasant food that you could make. It's like a kind of boiled beef and vegetable broth, but he's going to kind of elevate it into high art with the help of Eugenie. And the film actually, like, rather than being interested in that kind of one-upmanship and machismo and all that kind of stuff, it's far more interested in like his relationship with Eugenie. They have a kind of sexual relationship, but they're not partners, and all that, you know, that she has kind of rebuffed many requests for marriage, and you know, there is still a kind of distance between them as kind of like that their professional relationship doesn't maybe allow them to become a couple, even though that they're working in such harmony that you think it would work. But you know, there is an uncertainty on her part that she doesn't want to ruin this idyll.
I mean, we often have mentioned on the podcast that like France just seems to have this like steady stream of like films for grown-ups, in the way that perhaps in the UK we don't get so much. You think this sort of falls into this category as being like a mature film with mature themes?
I mean, when you say it like that, you instantly think of, like, you know, oh, there's going to be some extreme sexual violence in it. And that's very much not the case for this film. I think some of the stuff that it's dealing with about human relationships and love and what that means and how that relates to our kind of professional lives and having to sort of, time as well, like the sort of inexorable ticking of the clock, I think that might be better understood by a more mature audience, in that, you know, the two characters here are kind of, you know, they're sort of slightly, they're not teenagers or 20 somethings, they're people who are very worldly and have had all this experience in their lives. That's not to say I don't think like a younger audience wouldn't appreciate this film, because I think that one of the sort of sub themes of it as well is that it's really beautiful, actually. Like, it's about the tragedy of potentially losing all this, you know, like death is sometimes something where it's a case of like you're losing this repository of knowledge and skill, and that maybe that our time on Earth should be about asking how we can actually pass that forward and bring it to the next generation, and not be selfish about the skills that we have. And, you know, part of the film, there is a sort of what would you call her, like an intern, or like
commie? No, sous chef would be like normally second command. Commie is normally kind of like almost like apprentice role, like, yeah, you're learning the different stations, the different skills.
So it's like an apprentice thing, and she is someone who they have earmarked as having this kind of great talent and a really kind of complex taste as well. And yeah, so like, you know, the focus in the end becomes about like, how can we pass this on? How can we continue when this knowledge is seemingly gone into the dust? And yeah, it's a very kind of beautiful film. It's one of those films where I don't think there's really a kind of, there's no like three act structure to it. It's very kind of just sort of drifts along, and it passes along with the season. It just has beautiful scene after beautiful scene, and it doesn't tease you with the food preparation. It's really all about that. Like, there's so much of it in the film. It, you know, that it's a really important part of like the pleasure of seeing this film. But yeah, I've seen it a couple of times now and just love it.
I'm a big fan as well. I don't know if you know this, but the person who consulted on this film is a very famous French chef called Pierre Gagné. And he's in the film very briefly, but I think he consulted on the food. And to me, like, knowing as much about his kind of history as a chef as I do, it felt kind of like strangely confessional and like slightly about him, because he was kind of very much at the forefront of like preserving these old French techniques, kind of having a real sense of like French history and his food, but then also including kind of modern elements in his restaurants in France, and, you know, got every accolade going. And then he did kind of the opposite of what Dodin did when he came to London. He opened a restaurant called Sketch, which is everything that's wrong with food culture in one place, and has gotten every accolade and will charge you £40 for a gin and tonic, and the food is terrible and overpriced. And just like, if you want to see what selling out does, you want to see what inauthenticity is, go to that. So it just kind of, yes, whilst he still maintained this space in France where he really is like a master of his craft. So yeah, strangely, I felt like I was watching a little bit of a sort of sliding doors version.
That's
of
fascinating. I did not know that. I did, you know, that does put an extra sort of dimension on the film. And I mean, you know, like, I think that the role he plays is the prince's chef who actually lists, you know, he announces this menu. The film kind of cuts off before it's finished because it's just never ending, as a kind of joke. And yeah, maybe that, like, you know, that's a bit of a joke on him and his, you know, his perhaps latter years kind of selling out. But I think the practical stuff he brings to the film, though, is incredible.
Truly, and very much more based in his origins. So it felt to me, yeah, it felt like a little bit of a kind of longing for what he'd not left behind, because his restaurants in France still exist and he is one of the most celebrated chefs of our time. But I couldn't help but think of Sketch when I was listening to him list off that menu. But do you want to get some scores on this in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Yeah, I probably go for like 4-5-5. Tran Anh Hung hasn't really done a film for quite a while. He had one that he did maybe like 5 or 6 years ago that never really got any kind of a release, which I haven't sought out. But yeah, this is a kind of mega return to form for him, and back to those really great films he was making in the noughts. And I'm actually a big fan of his adaptation of Murakami's Norwegian Wood, which I know people are quite mixed on because it's quite a kind of maudlin novel, but like I really like that as well, and I think that this is a great movie. I hope people go and see it, and it's not just a kind of flavor of the month type thing. Worth saying in a very kind of blunt force way that the performances from Binoche and Majimal are extraordinary. It really kind of hangs on their performances and how much they're kind of, they're just present in those roles, and you believe that they are having these reactions to the food.
Yeah, no, absolutely wonderful film. I really do agree. I think I was a two coming in, I have to say, because I kind of had just like visions of Chocolat and thought it might just kind of be a bit twee. And I am a little bit protective when it comes to depictions of food and what like the Croft takes. As soon as that sort of long extended opening sequence where they're making a meal happened, I was, yeah, just on cloud nine. So maybe a 5-4 in retrospect. I'd be excited to watch it again without sort of my expectations. And also I do question, I was very hungry when I watched it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure in which direction that would have tempered my experience, but I would be curious to see it on a not so empty stomach. Next up, it's One Love. One Love follows the music icon Bob Marley from the mid-70s until his untimely death in 1981, where the reggae superstar and activist faced violent backlash, personal crises, and creative conflicts. So, David, we weren't necessarily actually going to even cover this week, but we were aware that we both saw it. And yeah, disappointed doesn't begin to cover it for me. Did you have high expectations coming in?
Yeah. Modest, like it was a film that suddenly started seeing like billboards and ads for everywhere, like a real kind of blanket marketing campaign. And when you see that, I guess the suggestion is like, oh, it's like a film that a distributor is putting some money behind and they're trying to promote and there's value in it, and that this is going to help it be really successful. You know, sometimes when a distributor doesn't see that value in a film, they can kind of dump it a little bit, and you maybe see a few ads on the tube, but that's it. So I kind of felt like, oh, this is a bigger deal than I imagined. The other thing that I thought was like the fact that it's called Bob Marley One Love, which is the title of the film. I just thought it was a documentary, like almost a sort of a few hours before I went to see this press screening, I was like, this is a documentary, right? And then I sort of looked it up and I was like, oh no, it's actually a fiction film. But I guess it's that thing of like the name One Love wouldn't have necessarily translated into viewers' minds that it was going to be a Bob Marley film. So they had to kind of very inelegantly stick Bob Marley in the title just to sort of hammer that home. It's a Bob Marley film. But I think what they've done by accident is make people think it's a documentary. But who knows? That might have just been me. So yeah, anticipation not necessarily muted, but confused.
I mean, I would say that like in some ways the best bit of this for me was the sort of real life footage montages that happen over the credits. So maybe it should have been a documentary. That footage was fabulous.
I really think that there's a thing with these films that it's so often the case where you're watching this film where you've got someone who's cosplaying as a music star or, you know, or something, and then you see the real footage. That they always do it over the closing credits. You know, they're almost like they're kind of the reason they put that footage there is pure hubris. To say, look, what we've shown you is real. Look how close this is to the real footage. You know, we have made this kind of duplication of that, and this actor has got all these nuances and mannerisms down, and this accent, and etc. etc. But every time you watch that footage, and you're like, this is so much better. This is like it always makes the film look bad every time. I feel that, like, if ever you can get away with it, don't bother showing us the reality that you've duplicated, because you're never going to be, you know, it's never going to be better.
But it's even more puzzling in this case, because we have in this, I mean, this is, what, 6 years, or I think 5 or 6 years of his life that we're covering. And, like, you get a lot of times where he's talking about a thing he really wants to do. Like, he wants to unite these warring factions in Jamaica. He wants to tour in Africa. And then they don't show them to you. And then they put the footage of him doing it in the montage at the end, to the point where I was sat there thinking, like, was there a fire with a hard drive or some film? Because it, even though this is not a short film, it felt like some footage was missing. Like, I could not understand the logic behind what they show and they don't show. Like, why did I see him play football so many times? Why did I see so much about the album cover of Exodus and I didn't see him touring Africa, or the incredible moment where he kind of brings Jamaica's opposition together and, you know, like, all of the things that he accomplishes? And I think the stuff around his death was very, very weird, where they kind of make him seem foolish. I don't know what happened here, because I quite liked King Richard.
Yeah, no, same. The same director behind King Richard, Reinaldo Marcus Green. And this film just feels generally quite rushed. And one of the weird things about the film, maybe you felt this too at the screening, is that I go into a biopic now and I'm sort of crossing out 2.5 hours in my diary as a kind of, like, mm-hmm. Well, you know, if it's someone really famous like this, then there's no way they're going to bring this in under 2 hours. And this, it's about, like, 90 minutes. I mean, is it like under 100 minutes, this film? Like, which is very strange for a biopic. Like, you're like, there's, you know, something has to be missing. And yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, say what you will about the film Bohemian Rhapsody, at least they end by showing the Live Aid performance, and you actually mm-hmm. seeing that, and they're actually taking pains to replicate it. You know, whatever other faults that film has, and there are many, you know, at least it gives you the full picture, whereas this one just kind of cuts off at a point and you're like, oh, we don't actually need to see that, or see that done, or I don't know, maybe they filmed it and didn't include it in the edit, like maybe it just didn't work, or you know, I don't know, like maybe they always knew that they could use the real footage to kind of depict that rather than have to, like, copy it. But yeah, I think it's a film that is very diplomatic, would probably be a kind way of putting it. His estate are obviously, like, involved, and, you know, they've given rights to all the music, and, you know, you do have these instances where you have non-official music biopics. You know, there's been one about David Bowie, and I think there was another one.
Well, I suppose Priscilla didn't get the rights.
Well, Priscilla as well. Yeah. So, I mean, the David Bowie one was also quite bad, but the Priscilla is a great example of, like, a film that is able to use the life of a famous person and actually make a valuable statement about them, rather than just like, and he did this, and then he did this, and then he did this, and everything's been approved, and we can't depict things in a way that kind of skew it too far to this way or too far to that way. And I think even down to the fact that when he's talking, the sequence where he is being told that he has the melanoma on his toe, which is going to be a death sentence for him if he didn't act straight away, and his decision not to do that is done. It's done in a kind of way where he's like, well, you know, obviously it was, you know, it seems like illogical and foolish for him not to want to sort of extend his life and do everything he could to save his life. But, you know, they frame it as him, like, sticking to the creed that he has presented through all his music and all his life, and, you know, his politics as well. And, you know, they present it as him being fairly happy to die, if anything. Like, you know, he's very comfortable with his mortality, and, you know, that's it.
And I'm no conspiracy theorist, but I don't believe that we necessarily know exactly what happened. I do believe there's a little bit of fuzziness around the circumstances of Bob Marley's death too. I mean, like, you know, I don't want to kind of go too crazy, but he was a person that was targeted. And I don't know that you can kind of present it as being like as benign as it was. And I think it's something like Jackie captures extremely well, where it's like, we're not saying that it's one thing, but we're just saying that this is a much, there's a sort of darkness around this.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, you know, I don't think it's a film that has any desire, or I think probably the makers had any real ability to sort of cloud the gospel reality of you know, the official line on his life. That's very much what we're getting here. You know, as there's a really fun moment where you see the recording of the song Exodus that's done in a way that's very kind of organic, and you know, it's maybe the one scene in the film that's not a very kind of wiki sanctioned depiction of some biography, where you actually see a moment of like, oh, this is about creativity, this is about how Bob Marley actually created music, and there is something quite authentic about it. But those kind of sequences are few and far between. I mean, one of the things that really kind of troubled me in many ways was the fact that, I mean, you know, he had many children from many different women, and you know, I think that everyone has ways that they organize their life, and there are many children that maybe don't have fathers or don't have mothers, or families form in ad hoc ways. But, you know, there is very much a sense in this film of like, he is an artist genius. The fact that he has kind of sired all these children doesn't matter, because he needs to be making music and making money and doing these important political things. And his children are kind of just scattered around as kind of flotsam. And you know, it's a bit like there's a sequence at the end where you know, that it's trying to suggest that, oh, well, he did have a relationship with his kids and he did give them these special moments. But I just didn't really believe it. And I felt throughout the film that, like, you know, I wasn't on side with that idea of like having that sort of dereliction of duty, you know, that kind of fatherhood being just some sort of like thing that happens in the background. That probably like loads of women had to deal with.
Yeah, and just that it kind of weighs on no one. I mean, even exactly. If he's kind of blasé, but you know, there's. But I have to say, when you started talking about what you found very disturbing, I did think you were going to talk about the wigs, because wow, what a selection of wigs.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess they've got to try as best they can to do the wigs in a film like this. But yeah, they're quite conspicuous, shall we say.
Yes. What Bohemian Rhapsody did to Freddie Mercury's teeth, One Love does to Bob Marley's hair, I would say.
Yeah.
Scores. Scores on this one. In anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect.
Probably, like, I'm saying it's a 3-2-2. I don't think it's like an offence. If anything, it's one of those things of like giving it a 2-star is maybe even giving it, is worse than giving it a 1-star, because I don't think it even has that kind of sense of, oh, I it's so bad, you kind of have to see it. I just think it's very, bland, middling, forgettable film, really. Despite the best efforts of people like Lashana Lynch, who I love, and even Kingsley Benadire in the lead role. I mean, you know, I really like him as a performer, and you know, I feel that looking for some of the sort of positives, that, you know, he's obviously put a great deal into sort of trying to get the Jamaican patois, which, you know, he does throughout the film, but yeah, it's at the service of something that I just don't think is particularly worthwhile.
Yeah, and no, I agree with you. I think generally acting wise, people are innocent. I think Kingsley and Lashana are both very strong. Some people are squandered. I couldn't understand why James Norton has such a small, thankless part, and Michael Ward basically doesn't have any dialogue. But I think I'm generally like a 3-2-1. And the one comes not because it's so offensive so much as, like, you know, you don't get to have that many opportunities as a biopic. And so it's like quite depressing to me that, like, for at least a decent amount of time, this is going to be the Bob Marley one. And like, who knows what we'll get next? Because it would have to really fail disastrously and like completely be erased from like the cultural imagination to justify somebody making another. So yeah, squandered opportunity makes it kind of a one for me. Kind of robbed of what I think could have been a really brilliant film. So I suppose we're saying skip that, and instead, David, you're going to give us a non-movie recommendation, something to do perhaps instead.
Okay, this is a weird one. I have got this like old retro, well, you'd call it a retro games console, a Super Nintendo. I sort of was doing a bit of a clear out and found it in the in my wardrobe, and sort of and this weekend I kind of ended up cleaning it off and dusting it and using some like Q-tips to kind of get all the kind of grot off it, and fired it up again, and it was like in perfect working order. So I spent a little time revisiting some of the games that I was playing in my kind of early teens, so like many years ago now, and one of the ones that I really enjoyed is this game. This is very old school. It's a game called Uni Rally. Is that a game that's come across?
And that does sound familiar. My sister's a big gamer. I do remember that being around.
It's a game where you're racing unicycles and you're doing stunts with unicycles, and it's kind of a little bit famous because it was, you know how Pixar has the lamp? Well, Pixar sued the makers of this game Uni Rally because it had these like sentient unicycles, because they looked a bit similar to the sentient lamp. Oh. They're kind of like, if you win, the unicycle kind of bows, and if you lose, it kind of like falls on the floors and cries. Pixar won this case, and the game was kind of discontinued. And I still think it's probably, you know, if you wanted to play it, there's loads of copies floating around out there. But like, it's a really good game. It's a really fun. It's a really, really good, fun sort of like innovative racing game. And yeah, I ended up like spending a few hours catching up, like playing Uni Rally over the weekend in a bid to stick it to the Pixar man.
Wow. I mean, they're not doing great either in terms of creative output.
Uni Rally won in the end.
Winner down, but fair enough. So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next time, we'll be discussing two highly anticipated titles, Dune Part 2 and Evil Does Not Exist. And we have a very exciting interview or two in the mix. Thanks.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.